This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Today I'm with Cormac Purcell from the University of Sydney. Hi, Cormac.
Hello.
You actually are quite familiar with Manchester, as you were here a few years ago as a postdoc.
That's right. I've spent over four years here.
So welcome back.
Sorry, okay, sorry really about good weather. To be back.
So... you've come to Manchester and you just gave a talk where you titled it The Gum Nebula as a Probe of Galactic Structure and the Galactic Magnetic Field, basically. So I think the logical way to start this off would be just ask you a little bit about magnetic fields in the Milky Way, why they're interesting, and how we can measure them.
Okay. So when we look at other galaxies, what we find is that, for instance, if you look towards a spiral galaxy, the magnetic field that you measure is also spiral in pattern. And the question is, how does this magnetic field get generated? Well, there are a number of different theories about how magnetic fields came to be in the universe from the start. They all rely on some small field in the first stars. So you get a little battery effect happening in the first stars formed in the universe. And then these dynamo processes amplify magnetic fields until you get to the large magnetic fields of the present day. Now, there are a number of different dynamo processes, so some of these are driven by turbulence in the gas between stars.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get this mixing of gas which twists the field lines and then amplifies it, so fields grow. So looking at magnetic fields in the galaxy can tell you about how the magnetic fields grow, what sort of ordered field there is, whether it follows a spiral pattern, and what sort of turbulent field there is. Their relative strengths tell you something about how the magnetic fields were formed.
Okay, yeah. So basically you have what you call the ordered field, just the spiral pattern that you see on
Correct.
A very large scale. And then when you go into smaller scales, you can see sort of random fluctuations that are due to other things just
yes.
within that galaxy.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. And so how strong are these fields? Like, well, how strong are they, for starters?
Both the ordered and the turbulent field that we can measure in our galaxy are of order around 2 micrograms.
Okay, so they're fairly, like, sort of weak overall.
Yes.
In speaking in sort of spatial terms. But
So, I mean, if you think that the ordered field runs over kiloparsecs.
Yeah.
And then as you get to smaller and smaller scales, I mean, processes associated with star formation and collapse can amplify those fields in specific region. But on average, that's the strength.
Okay, how do we detect these things? How do we see that they're there? Because obviously you can't just look up into space and see magnetic fields.
Yeah, you can't sprinkle iron filings on the sky and
exactly.
see how it goes. Well, actually, you kind of can in one sense. One of the ways you can detect fields is by looking at dust. So if you have dust grains, they generally tend to be not spherical pellets. They tend mm-hmm. to be elongated. And if they accumulate a charge at all, then what can happen is they can act like tiny magnets and then align themselves to the magnetic field. So you can think of your magnetic compass needle floating on some water or on a pivot, and then it just turns. Of course, space is a good vacuum, so there's no
yeah.
impediment to this. And if you have whole sheets of dust grains that line up along a particular direction, they act as a polarizing filter. So just like the filter in your sunglasses, they'll block one direction of polarization.
Yep.
And if you have a filter on your telescope and you can rotate it and measure which direction of polarization is getting through, then you can see different angles of magnetic field in the Milky Way. And this works for regions that are close to us. So, I mean, the solar system is embedded in layers of dust and, mm-hmm. and dust clouds marching off into space, and you can look at these. Unfortunately, optical and infrared wavelengths can only penetrate so far through this dust. So you need to go to longer wavelengths and use other techniques. The technique that I use at the moment is a thing called Faraday rotation.
Okay.
So if you have a parcel of electrons or gas containing electrons, and it's threaded by a magnetic field, then polarized light from outside of that parcel of gas will have its angle of polarization rotated as it travels through.
Right.
You can measure this and figure out what magnetic field gave rise to it.
Okay, great. So that Faraday rotation, that's basically using radio waves at this point.
That's right.
So that's that is the most sort of widespread technique, I guess. And so we use this to measure the fields both in other galaxies and our own galaxy, but it's much more difficult to measure the field in our own galaxy, right?
So the difficulty we have being in our own galaxy is our vantage point. you can look at external galaxies and you can say, yep, there's a spiral field there because you're looking at it from the top. You can do the same looking at it edge on and you can see the field that's extending out into the halo.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that here with our galaxy as well. But unfortunately, because we're embedded deep within the disk, there's a lot of confusing features which interrupt our line of sight.
Right.
And all of these things are likely to have some sort of magnetic signature as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to take care of the stuff that's in your own backyard or clear it out or sort of correct for it so that you can see the large scale field of the galaxy itself.
Okay, so what's our best guess? We still think it's a spiral though, I mean, presumably because the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy as well.
Yeah. So one of the things that you can do is that you can use individual objects which sit at different distances throughout the disk as probes of the magnetic field, either along the line of sight or in their local regions. Pulsars are one such thing.
Mm-hmm.
So pulsars sit in the disk at a particular distance, and depending on how much gas their pulses of light has passed through, then the pulses spread out in time. They also are polarized, and so you can look at how their polarization changes as they spread out, and compare it to how much the pulses has spread it out.
Mm-hmm.
And by comparing these two, you can get an independent estimate of the number of electrons and the magnetic field along the line of sight.
Right.
So that's one way of anchoring these models that we have of the galactic magnetic field. Another way is to use individual objects which somehow perturb the magnetic field.
Okay.
So if you think of a bubble in space, what we're trying to do often is look at how that bubble changes the light flowing through it from behind.
So just to clarify, you mean like kind of a bubble of hot gas, basically?
Correct,
right?
Yes.
Okay, and so you've actually focused a lot of your work recently on one of these particular bubbles, or something at least that affects this magnetic field, which is known as the Gum Nebula.
That's right.
So could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so if you imagine that the full moon on the sky takes up about half a degree, the Gum Nebula, visible from the southern hemisphere, is a faint nebula of ionized gas that it covers 36 degrees on the sky.
Wow.
So it's absolutely enormous. It would stretch from horizon to horizon when it's up full. And the thing is, it's quite faint. And so you see it only when you put a filter on your telescope. Thankfully, we have very good maps of this in a line called H-alpha, which traces ionized gas.
Okay.
And so there's nice pictures of this. You can go online and just look it up. It's beautiful. But it's very close, and its front face is almost touching the Earth, only a few tens of parsecs away.
Yeah.
By using the Gum as a depth charge, if you like, we can see how the original explosion or the original bubble that was blown or the process that was driving it affected the local magnetic field. And it enhances the ionization in a region, and because the ionization is enhanced, you get a much better handle on what the magnetic field is doing in that ionized region. And one of the questions is the bubble compressing the magnetic field? And what direction is the magnetic field flowing as it threads that bubble? And that gives us another anchor point in one of these large models of the global galactic ordered field.
Okay. So one of the points in your talk was that basically we don't know exactly how the Gum formed or essentially what it is. And most the consensus theory at the moment is that it's kind of a supernova remnant. So basically exploding star ejects a whole bunch of gas and then just creates this expanding shockwave that makes this kind of shape on the sky. But you're saying that it might not be that.
Yeah. So I mean, the Gum was discovered in the mid-50s by an astronomer called Colin Gum. And since its discovery, the astronomers have been arguing back and forth in the literature just to say, nope, it's a H2 region. No, it's a windblown bubble. No, it's a supernova remnant. No, it's a multiple copy or multiple superposition of different things.
Yeah, because it's a pretty busy region in the sky. There's a lot of stuff going on there.
It is.
There?
So it overlaps the sort of galactic midplane, and there's H2 regions, bubbles blown by stars. There's smaller supernova remnants. There's many other different things like pulsars and so on that just confuse you. So we looked at the topmost region of the Gum, which is relatively unconfused.
Okay.
And we were able to sort of look at how the magnetic field changed across the region, how the Faraday rotation changed, and try and fit a simple model to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the model was of an ionized shell.
Yep.
And it included some compression at the edge. So if the gas at the edge was compressed, then the rotation measure signal that we'd get and the magnetic field would be compressed. And you'd see that in an image of the sky, or by looking at the rotation measures from background objects, they would be enhanced around the edge of the gum.
Yeah.
And the fact that we didn't see that mean that there wasn't a huge amount of compression there. Now, this sort of compression, you would expect to find it in a H2 region or windblown bubble, so a compression of maybe 4 to 6.
So let me just kind of try and get jargon bust a little bit. When you talk about compression, so essentially you've got this spherical shell of gas of some thickness, and it's just basically running up against other stuff that's just kind of crumpling it a little bit and just kind of pushing all the ionized gas closer together.
Correct.
So then what you're saying is that if this ionized gas just gets kind of squashed together, it's going to be more dense, and it's going to essentially rotate the polarized light going through it by a sort of larger factor because there's just more electrons there, essentially.
Yes.
Just to try and simplify things a little bit.
Correct. But also it's going to push the field lines together.
Also, yeah.
So the magnetic field in itself will be enhanced. So you've got a double whammy.
Sure. Okay, and so what you're saying is that if it were a supernova remnant, this squashing of the gas would be much larger because it's basically just a much more forceful event.
Correct.
If you have just a H2 region or a stellar wind bubble, which I'm going to get back to you as well on that, that it would just be much lower, and so that's what characterizes it basically.
Yes.
And so, could you talk a little bit about sort of bubbles blown by stars? Because it sounds very poetic, and it's not necessarily obvious how that occurs.
Yeah. Sure. So if you have a star over a certain mass, so usually accepted at about 8 times the mass of our sun, it's more energetic. There's more mass going into fusion. It emits a spectrum that's closer to the blue end of the light. So stars over 8 solar masses, they emit most of their light in the ultraviolet.
Mm-hmm.
And ultraviolet light has the property that it has enough energy that it can split the electron off in the hydrogen atom.
Sure.
And so what you get is you get a whole lot of electrons in a sea of gas around the star, which have been liberated from interstellar H1, so hydrogen gas. As the star goes on, and as it keeps on pumping out this UV light, the bubble of gas that's ionized around the star expands out, essentially at a constant rate.
Sure.
And so you get these bubbles being blown around stars. If the star is more massive again, then you can also get a particle wind from the star. So radiation pressure in the top layers of the atmosphere of the star can take heavier particles and dust and actually impart some momentum and blow it outwards. And so this stream of particles from the star can batter into the gas and then compress it even more. So that's an even more energetic event.
Okay.
And then other stars, I mean, at the end of their lifetime, these massive stars, when they die and they undergo supernovas, you're setting off a nuclear bomb. So what you're doing is you have a blast wave that spreads into the medium. And as the blast wave spreads out, it entrains mass. So it sweeps up all of this gas.
Mm-hmm.
And as the gas in the shell is swept up, the shell gets heavier and heavier and heavier until eventually it slows down enough and dissipates out into the rest of the interstellar medium.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, okay, cool. So that's excellent. So going back to the gum, basically what you're saying is that according to the observations that you made, that it only has has certain properties that make you think that it's not at all a supernova remnant, but rather that it's caused by basically stellar wind coming from other stars that are located within that region of the sky.
Yep.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, what we try to do is we look at background galaxies far out in the universe than our own, which are the equivalent of point sources to us because they're so far away. They have a particular set of polarization properties that we can measure. And if you think of the analogy of holding a soap bubble in front of your face and looking at a Christmas tree through it, you get the light from the individual points on the Christmas tree, the individual lights, distorted around the edge of the soap bubble.
Yeah.
Well, we're using the background galaxies in the same way as you would do that with a Christmas tree, except what we're looking at is the polarization.
Mm-hmm.
So the polarization properties get distorted by the Faraday rotation.
Sure. Okay, yeah, and that builds up like kind of a profile of what you're looking at.
Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant. And so you found something interesting as well, which is that when you measure kind of the slightly larger scale magnetic field around the gum, and you find the field has a so-called angle. So when you talk about the pitch angle of the magnetic field in a spiral, it's basically how much that field is inclined with respect to this kind of the axis, I suppose. And so you find something that basically doesn't agree with sort of large-scale pitch angle measurements of the galaxy.
Yeah. So if you think of a circle drawn around the center of the galaxy that passes through the location of the gum. A pitch angle of zero would mean that the magnetic field just flows around that circle. A negative pitch angle would mean that the magnetic field is spiraling outwards, and a positive pitch angle would mean that the magnetic field is spiraling inwards.
Right.
And so what we did was we looked at the gum as a probe of this and fit some models, and we found that the gradient of rotation measure that we got across the gum along the galactic plane was best fit by a model which had the magnetic field actually spiraling inwards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is at odds with the spiral pattern of the galaxy, because we know that the spiral arms spiral outwards.
Yeah.
And what we think is happening here is that this is just a local deviation.
Right.
This actually does make sense. Other people have done surveys of the magnetic field in our local area, mm-hmm. much closer to the sun, by looking at polarized light through dust grains.
Yep, yep.
And they find even larger deviations. And so you see this effect also in other galaxies. So another astronomer, George Heald, found that there was a super bubble in the face of one of these spiral galaxies, which mm-hmm. had one of these gradients you could measure in rotation measure. And this looks very similar to what we see. So it might just be a ubiquitous feature of a star formation in the spiral arms, where you get expanding bubbles or shock fronts, which then disturb the gas and twist up the ordered magnetic field.
Right. So this is something different to the whole kind of several scales of magnetic field.
Yes.
So this is literally, you've got this kind of ordered field that gets twisted up in the spiral
yes.
arms.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really cool. Excellent. Well, anyway, thanks a lot for talking to us today,
yeah,
Cormac.
My pleasure.
And yeah, it's been a pleasure having you. And hopefully you can come back to Manchester in a few years' time and do your third podcast interview.
Absolutely.
Cheers.